Let the record reflect. It's approximately 3:30 p.m. on this Monday afternoon, February 14th, 2011. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone here and watching on the camera. The record should reflect that we do have a quorum. Beginning on my right, we have Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator Pascvan, co-chair Senator Wagner, and Senator Stedman. We will be joined soon by Senator Stevens, Senator McGuire. Here's Senator Stevens as we speak, so welcome. Senator McGuire is excused for today. Please turn off your cell phones, even on the vibrating component. It interferes with the audio and video transmission, so again, please turn off your cell phones. We're going to hear two presentations today. We have representatives from Energy Cura, which means energy cure, and that's about a fit-for-purpose natural gas pipeline system to deliver affordable gas from Prudhoe Bay to interior Alaska and perhaps to south central Alaska. The second presentation will be by Mr. Larry Persley. And he will present an overview of a paper written by Roger Marks of the Office of the Federal Coordinator, and that paper is entitled Opportunity Cost in Comparison of Subsidizing an In-State Gas Pipeline versus the Benefits to Alaska of a Mainline to the Lower 48. The committee looks forward to both of these presentations. I think it bears pointing out that there's been discussion of a gas line from the North Slope for 30 years or so, shortly after the oil line was built. We all know that there's an incredible gas resource on the North Slope, and one of the questions is how do the citizens of Alaska, and primarily to those citizens in interior Alaska who are living very close to the North Slope, receive any benefit when it comes to heating their homes, heating their businesses, and heating their schools? And one of those concepts is a small diameter gas pipeline, and such is Energy Cura's thought. So with that, I would welcome Alex Gagos and Diane Benson. Please, both of you, please come forward and present the merits of Energy Cura's small diameter gas line from Prudhoe. State your name and affiliation.
Alex Gagos with Energy Cura. This lovely lady next to me is Diane Benson, who's joined our team as late as about 2.5 weeks ago.
And how is it that you would prefer to begin the presentation?
Well, I'd like to take a few minutes of your time today to do an introductory before I turn it over to Alex Gagos. Certainly want to thank you for your time on this Valentine's Day. My name is Diane Benson, and I am presenting on behalf of Fairbanks Pipeline Company, which is founded by Energy Cura. And I want to talk to you about the Arctic Fox Natural Gas Pipeline Project. Alex Gagos will follow with some details regarding the plan. The Fairbanks Pipeline Company was created by these visionary founders of Energy Cura for a single purpose: to build a small-diameter in-state pipeline that would bring gas from the North Slope to Fairbanks and closer to other Alaskan markets in a sooner-than-later time frame. As a matter of fact, Alaska needs an in-state natural gas pipeline, and we have an Alaska solution. The goals of the Arctic Fox Natural Gas Pipeline are to lower energy costs, improve air quality, net the highest value, retain wealth in Alaska, and provide investment opportunities for Alaskans and use the best transport methods for the gas. It's unique in a number of ways. Unlike other projects, the Arctic Fox line will compete in a market environment defined by 50% avoided cost factors. Private oil and gas marketing, pricing and margins, strategies are typically based on what markets can bear. Fairbanks Pipeline Company's goal is not focused on finding or resolving attainable profits. Rather, it is to bring Alaskan residents affordable gas while keeping retained earnings circulating in our local in-state economies. And you have to admit, this is a noble goal, and that a commitment of this kind by Alaskans for Alaskans is notable, albeit a little unusual in this industry. It's just thinking out of the box, and why not? Transportation of gas is more expensive to transport than crude oil when viewed on an energy equivalent basis. But it is also a lower cost commodity than crude, and because of such, and I think Alex will explain it, any gas pipeline installed to move ANIS gas should be owned and controlled by Alaskans. These two individuals, Tom Chapman and Alex Gatos, are intent on putting an end to the Alaska's expensive path to trying to choose an option. And they have funded this development to date to advance Alaska's prosperity. Frankly, that's Alaskan ingenuity, supported by real commitment. It cannot be said enough. A pipeline that serves Alaska can be built by Alaskans, for Alaskans, and without state subsidies. A pipeline sized to match ANIS Gas's utility value can be constructed without state subsidies. And assuming that its 11% return on investment inspires the relatively small individual investments required for Alaskans to partake in its ownership and future earnings, I'd like to say that if TAPS had provided for Alaskan investment in the same way, I, as a young mother, would have taken a portion of my dividend, my permanent fund dividend each year, and made that investment without hesitation. I mean, many of us would be doing pretty darn well today if that opportunity had been available. Well, today we can do something through this project. The Arctic Fox Pipeline Project and the Alaska Holding Company provide an opportunity to not only profit through dividends, but it's the knowing that we Alaskans could be contributing to our Alaska's future together. Now, this last September, I just drove the Dalton Highway up and back to Prudhoe Bay. And I also used to drive it as a construction worker during the construction of the TAPS pipeline. I worked up there all 3 years. I drove tractor trailers up there. I know that road well. I know it's dangerous. And I can tell you that as a trucker, the Chandelier Shelf is always a challenge. And I still saw those truckers that were coming down to this day nail-biting their way down that thing. So that hasn't changed. There is construction up there in the Chandelier Shelf area. And I think given the way that they've modified the road through that particular region opens up more possibility for getting a gas line or any other anything else through there. It's certainly more doable than it was in 1977. And I wish I had some pictures from that trip to show you. That was beautiful. The Arctic Fox Natural Gas Pipeline can be built within the width of the Dalton Highway, which is designated at its minimum at 200 feet. The Arctic Fox Line does not rely, and I think this is important to point out, on exportation, and this is another place where we depart ways with other projects. The Fairbanks Pipeline Company objective is to provide for Alaska's needs for Alaska's benefit. This needs to be seriously considered because so much is at stake for our state and our future. A relatively simple gas pipeline easement, as granted in many other states, is preferable to both the state of Alaska's long-term interest and the project's timeline. Fairbanks Pipeline Company wants to get underway and have gas headed to Alaskan's markets ideally by 2014. But we're having delays every day that we take in trying to make this decision bumps it forward. So we may be looking at 2015, depending on how this legislative session goes. It is within the state's power, though, under DNR and statutes, to provide access to the easement, access to the state's boring and geological data, and assistance with environmental permits regarding an existing corridor. It's not to say that there aren't challenges. But gosh, haven't we learned much over these years to now expedite the process in the best interests of the state, and they highly encourage us to do so. Furthermore, there are other opportunities for the state in the development of the Arctic Fox Pipeline, and that's in using that corridor in the form of gravel sales and reduced haul road cost maintenance and so forth, which I'm sure that Alex can address for you, any questions you have. The owners of the Fairbanks Pipeline Company, they are businessmen with a long history and experience and who care about the future of their state. The members of the company, as we see it, would reap their own benefits from the pipeline in the same way that other Alaskans and Alaskan companies will profit, and that's through the purchase and ownership of shares. Not only will Alaskans benefit by available, affordable gas, but what we want to see, what we envision, is earning dividends as well, making it a win-win. You know, it was a disturbing article the other day to see what's happened to Kansas, especially from rural residents in Kansas who feel like they got shortchanged because for the next 10 years, they're not going to see a dime off of a Trans-Canada line through their state. And they're not very happy. The legislature made some decisions on political assumptions. TransCanada came back and said, we didn't exactly make that decision, our decision, based on what you had to offer, and that means bumping the taxes for 10 years. I don't want to see Alaska make any bad decisions, and I know you don't either, on behalf of our residents. Fairbanks is in a real situation right now, and Alaska faces the same as a whole. Clearly, the state has certain obligations to Alaskans under constitutional law and statutes to make determinations in the best interests of the state. The state's Dalton Highway Master Plan states that one of the goals for its plan is to maximize economic development opportunities for Alaskans. You have an opportunity to move a project forward in the best interests of the state. When the state helps with permitting or otherwise expedites the permitting process when dealing with existing right-of-ways or acquisitions of easements or granting or utilizing leases of lands or easements or interests for existing pipeline right-of-way purposes, it makes clear that they are a business-friendly state. Bottom line, Alaskan companies should be able to compete. If nothing else, I leave you with this. Whatever your decisions, I implore you to consider providing for guarantees for certain socially beneficial parameters, such as minimum equity assignments to the state government and to state residents, directly through stock issuances or less directly through its load centers. Why? Because any effort should be to build a better future for Alaska. Alex Gatos will address other specifics about the project and the plan, and hopefully you will have some time to answer some questions. We will have some time, and that you can ask some questions. We certainly thank you for this time and opportunity to introduce this project to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we continue, I'd like to recognize we have Senator Giesel here and Senator Thomas also here. I don't see any other elected officials, but welcome to the both of you. So, Mr. Gatos, please provide your presentation.
Okay. Well, Chairman Pascavan and Co-Chair Wagner and the rest of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to present our project. And our hope is that while we don't have the time here to go through, it's a very complex project. There's a lot of complex issues involved. This is our first time to the table, and our hope is to spark a little fire and perhaps get another invitation to take you a little deeper into the project details. What Mr. Pascavan was talking about relative to interior cost in the business is in the business of resource management is called utility value. Utility value is essentially going beyond a single or two-dimensional management approach to resources, where all you're looking at is the tax and royalty cuts as those resources are extracted and imported. What we're requesting this committee to do is consider two other slices, which are typically addressed in other developed nations, and that's utility value. Utility value is essentially this slide here at 19 BCF per year. It's the difference between what your constituents will pay without the benefit of ANS gas or with the benefit of ANS gas. And as you can see there, for a small community, it's 1/6 of the state up in the interior, 100,000 strong. The current price points are egregious enough to where the differential between the two amounts in 20 years of $3.65 billion. Assuming some growth and we can move 30 BCF per year, which understanding all of the interior load centers as we do because we've worked for all of them, I can tell you that all those transportations are economic. That differential grows to $7.5 billion. So that in and of itself is what we call utility value. In other words, what that commodity is worth in state. An analogy would be, for example, if we owned a farm and we made hay and we kept horses. We made more hay than our horses ate, but we would be typically smart enough to keep enough hay to feed the horses. If we knew that the price, the alternative price of purchasing the hay back for our horses was double the cost, which is what we have going on here today. That's the utility value. The other thing our project brings to the table is it's maybe novel, but if you consider the history of
recording stopped
from day one relative to total value of commodities exported versus the amount of wealth retained in state, the idea of Alaskan pipeline ownership is what we bring to the table. And it's a very serious issue because if you understand the whole value
or Q&A options
of ANS gas, any gas, it's more expensive to transport than, for example, crude. If you look at the value, the total value chain of natural gas from the wellhead to the burner tip, biggest part of the pie over time is transportation. When we started flowing oil through taps, 2.3 million barrels per day, if you refresh your mind as to what the cost was, it was less than $12. Refresh your mind to what the cost of the tariff was, which was over $7, you start understanding the relationship of the value chain and the worth, intrinsic worth, of each link of that value chain. What this project brings to the table is a way for Alaskans to own that portion of the value chain. Our intent is really to take the wealth and resources the state has, called ANS gas, and as it's monetized, conceive of a way, a practical way, to keep as much of that wealth within our own state lines as possible, because the value of increasing that wealth over time through velocity of monies is a compounding effect similar to what you would make in a bank account. In the interior, the VOM factor is roughly 1.48. So if you take those avoided costs, what I call the utility, what the industry calls the utility, those numbers, you can add half again as much in terms of what that value means to Alaskans. No matter what we do, I think in managing our resources, the idea is to manage it to its best value. So that's what we're trying to engage this committee with, is the concept of not only looking at the single parameter of tax and royalties, which in gas is small. It's a very disappointing part of the equation relative to crude. Its value is much less. But what we're saying is, let's look at the utility value, as you see on the screen, and let's look at the value of ownership. So if we get back to our goals, if we read them, our goal is to lower Interior Alaska's non-discretionary energy costs. If you live in Fairbanks, when I left, it was 39 below. You have no choice. You have to purchase energy. The other concept we bring is an option. The obvious thing is the nominations we receive through our open season, the 19 BCF per year. What's not so obvious is the ability to install what's called in the industry an arbitrable flange. To do that for the benefit of the Cook Inlet, we can extrapolate the value, the utility value, from 1/6 of the total population in the interior and add another 4/6, which is the Cook Inlet. And the way we do that is to address the uncertainty associated with your future price points in Cook Inlet. We discussed that earlier.
Possibly, Mr. Gajos, if you could, go through like case one, and I'm looking at slide 10, okay. And then I think you have the flange concept also identified in there so that people can follow.
Thank you. That's a good idea. So the pictograph of what we're talking about, of course, is it emanates from Prudhoe Bay. The obvious is a 12-inch line from Prudhoe Bay to North Pole through Fairbanks to distribute 19 BCF of gas that we have signed nominations for and are available for review on our website. Those are essentially only 8 customers because the concept here is for a transmission system selling its gas to major load centers. There is already a utility in Fairbanks, a gas distribution utility. It's not very large. It's less than 1 BCF per year. There is interest from other parties to look into outbuilding that line. If FNG is not interested, I'm not certain why they wouldn't be. But nonetheless, the value that we were talking about for the Cook Inlet is to address the deputy of, not the deputy, but the director of oil and gas, Kevin Banks's recent statement where he talks of future E&P risk monies and associated costs producing gas, that's a little more expensive than what we're used to seeing in a Cook Inlet. He projected increases ranging from $5 to $13 in the next decade. We've ran our own analysis, and ours isn't quite as steep of a ramp as that. Nonetheless, we can see where it can approach $10, probably within 4 to 5 years. So what we did is took that 12-inch segment and did some hydraulic modeling and economic modeling, increased its girth to 18 inches, which, by the way, cost $287 million. That's the differential cost between the two pipe sizes. And what we looked at was terminating that in Livengood, which is a good central place to make a difference in direction between your interior market and the Cook Inlet market. At 18 inches, what we are recommending is that we install an arbitrable flange, which is for the pipe fitters of the world, it's nothing but a blind flange. In other words, what you've got there is an 18-inch pipe that's energized, flowing with gas, capable, by the way, of supporting the entire Cook Inlet's load today.
If I could interject now, I would welcome Representative Feige in the back. We welcome you, and then Senator French had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gajos, your capital cost estimation for constructing an 18-inch pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to North Pole is a little over $1 billion, if I understand the slide correctly, and yet that is substantially less than other estimates we've seen for similarly sized pipes. We've seen numbers as high as $7 billion, to go all the way to Anchorage, of course, but nevertheless, that suggests you know, a fairly large difference in the capital costs that you're estimating versus some of the ones we've seen in recent days. I wonder if you could comment on that difference and explain why you can build a pipeline for such a nice round sum of $1 billion.
Well, primarily is because we were a smaller board. The numbers you're talking about are actually the cost that you've seen from AGDC, the organization led by Mr. Dan Fowski. That's a 24-inch line, and that cost is not $6 or $7 billion, but it's $3.8 billion for the pipeline. His low-end cost for the project, which is at 24-inch, 70% larger than what the Cook Inlet market is today, is intrinsically tied to exportations. To do exportations, that project includes a significant capitalization of processing facilities, Tidewater LNG plant, which in our estimation are not feasible given the global gas economies. I'm sure with the news that we've all read here of the realities of what's going on in global marketplaces are becoming apparent. You've just read the ConocoPhillips' press release for the closure of the Kenai plant, which we predicted would happen this summer a year ago. They, in very simple terms, are telling you that in the Eastern Hemisphere, where labor is $1.32 an hour, where much more world-class gas reserves, cleaner, highly condensate-rich gas reserves are all located at Tidewater. The International Monetary Fund has written a paper, for example, on some investments in Qatar, three plants that were built right on top of the North Field, which is the world's largest non-associated gas field. It's 900 TCF versus our 37 TCF. In terms of commercializing it, let's lay aside for a minute the fact that our gas isn't as clean, it's not as condensate rich. The real differential is that Qatar's resources are at Tidewater. They don't require $40 billion of infrastructure to transport it from the wellhead to Tidewater. But we've, at Energy Acura, predicted and commented on the global markets for 4.5, 5 years. And what you see going on today is what's called the paradigm shift in the gas economies. You've seen it earlier trends were in 07. By the way, prior to the promulgation of AGEA, to people in the markets, well versed in the markets, the trend lines became apparent in 07. So what you have is not only the gas gluts, as inspired by the shale productions, which isn't going away tomorrow, but on the other side of the world, in the Eastern Hemisphere, as 07 went on through 08, 09, there's seven major plants, new plants that were built and came online. And they're putting LNG on the water. They're at rates below $5. There's some thought, the World Bank has written some papers, some expression that, for example, Qatar can sell their gas at negative value because it's so condensate rich. So $5 is essentially what ConocoPhillips responded to. What I've read in the press relative to ConocoPhillips was the extinguishment of its FERC license for operation, but what's actually transpired is the extinguishment of its contracts for primarily with Japan in the $12, $13, $14 range, which ConocoPhillips knows it cannot compete with Qatar Indonesia, Malaysia, and within about another 2 years, Australia. Okay, these are all world-class gas deposits. We, in terms of gas, we don't rate for two reasons: quality of gas, but primarily because of its stranded condition. The cost of building the infrastructure, take it to Tidewater or take it to the ACO hub, exceed its alternative value in the marketplace today. So that's as far as we need to go with that, I think.
Okay,
can we get back to the 18-inch?
Yeah, we have approximately 15 minutes left. Any follow-up questions?
Just a quick follow-up, and just for the record, the quote on the AGDC pipeline is $3 billion to Fairbanks, $3 billion. And they include $2.5 billion on top of that for a gas treatment plant. Could you address how your plan treats the gas?
Yes. If you look at the top right-hand corner of that slide, you will see a figure there. That's our gas fundamental. It's 422. Whereas the part of the reason why that cost is high, as I told you, is because it includes gas treatment. It includes compression stations. Our CAPEX does not. Our CAPEX is all about pipe, and it's only 12-inch on our case 1 basis, or it's 18-inch on a case 2A basis.
So just so I'm clear, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, you're saying you're paying extra for the gas at Prudhoe for it having been treated there already?
Correct. What we're doing is, as we're negotiating with the producers, and we've had meetings with all three, we're on our second round of discussions. We've actually received three proposals. It's a habit of ours. Four skid-mounted compressor stations, as well as treatment facilities. So we understand what our CAPEX is. At the same time, we looked at what our OPEX requirements would be, our operating costs over time. And in that analysis, our findings are that whether we build it or whether the majors build it on the North Slope, which in some ways is a modification of their existing utilities or facilities, the CGF and the compression plant up there, what we assumed is our CAPEX would be roughly equal. The reason we took this approach is because of the differential in the OPEX. They can leverage their existing resources far cheaper than a third party could, establishing camps, making the long trips. There's over time it amounts to a significant amount, and that's the approach we use there, which is, by the way, not unlike the approach in the common markets, where what you call market risk, which is how you get the resource from the wellhead to the conduit to market, which is a transmission line, typically what you have are third parties that provide treatment and compression at times. And if you are a leaseholder and you own some wells, you pay that third party to interpolate that commodity, move that commodity, treat it, take it to the market conduit. That has a cost which typically bears back against the wellhead value of the gas. And in the lower 48, in the common markets, that market risk is approximately 34 miles if you look at the piping. What we're assuming in our negotiations with the producers is that we utilize the U.S. average wellhead value as our basis, and we apply a discount for not only its quality, but we call its shared CAPEX risk, which is the same thing as market risk, because as opposed to any other gas well in the lower 48, what we have in front of us is 518 miles of market risk, and they understand that.
Thank you,
Senator. Yeah, just real quick, do you have a breakdown of your $4.22 per MCF figure? In other words, how much are they going to charge you to treat the gas on the slope, and how much are they going to charge you for the gas?
I can't tell you what they're going to charge me right now. All I can tell you is what it would cost us to do it if we built it and operated it. And that's the price you see right there.
Okay.
In our negotiations, that's our hope, we're going to shave that price a little bit and get some value out of the OPEX that we talked about, the differential.
Thank you.
Any follow-up?
No.
The average over last year was about $367 for the year, just to give you an idea. But you have to remember that U.S. wellhead value is based on the quality of the gas in question, also the market risk. And as I told you, if you look at the map of the United States and you look at all the transmission lines, you put your finger where a well is, it's usually very close to a transmission system. So that's the difference. That CAPEX risk, that market risk, is a discount to the wellhead value. In other words, whatever that is, when we finally negotiate it, that will be subtracted from the U.S. average wellhead value. To that will be applied the cost of compression, which is what it is. It's a function of horsepower and what's called shrinkage, the amount of gas you have to dedicate to run the turbines to motivate the and the cost of treatment. So it's actually pretty simple stuff, but once you get into it, it gets complicated real quick. And I think we've more or less run out of time. I didn't get through hardly any slides, but through the chairs, if anybody has any further questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe, Mr. Chairman, if you could have him give us just a brief 1-minute synopsis of where he's at and what impediment he sees in front of him stopping him from going forward and constructing the line.
Well, essentially, if you look at, through the chairman, if you look at our model is, the concept is for it to be owned a portion by the state up to 7.2%. A slice of it owned by its own, the people nominating gas. A slice of it owned by Alaskan companies, ranging from small business all the way to our larger native corporations. And about 38% left over out of that to the general public. And what we're offering are $100 par share that will be administered through our banking partner, similar to opening a bank account. These shares will not be publicly traded, so its equity component, its principal component, will remain fixed over time. And through the model's 12% rate of return applied on the transportation, what it does is provide a way to return earnings through dividends to those par shareholders of approximately 11%. Through the model, the amortization is loaded on a 20-year cycle, which means that after 20 years is over, the what we call our equity component, which under a different project would be called its debt component, would be satisfied. In other words, the pipeline's paid for in 20 years. Its design life would be 65 years, so the model keeps moving in time, and it keeps returning 11% dividends.
Any further questions? We're just about at the Senator Wagner.
Two-part question. We're in 2011, and your information, I read out some things after you left my office this morning, say that you can be operation by 2014. That's 3 years from now. Have you selected any contractors, or have you entered into any agreements with any construction contractors like Bechtel or anybody like that for this project?
I have worked with both engineering firms and construction firms on at arm's length on developing some of our numbers. The date in question was set when we started this project, and we spent a tremendous amount of effort and time in at the Atwood Building as of last year, through the last year. And the reality is that to construct the roadside pipeline of the scale we're talking about, 12 or 18 inches, you need two full winter seasons. And it was our hope, with a nod from the state, that then we could go back to the Price Gregory's through the Bechtel's, or predominantly we would prefer to do business with in-state, because we have the talent in-state. For example, ASRC, Arctic Energy, has got a very talented crew that could do this project. It fills and satisfies our model of containing this wealth and resources within state, trying what we can do to capture this money in state lines. It was our hope that with some indication from the state that it would support this project, and we're not asking for subsidies here. What we're suggesting is you take the assets that the state has already put together on the public coffer, the LIDAR data, geophysical data, make that available to these engineering firms so they can start detailed engineering. What these people would be working for would be not $100 bills, but they would be working through our bank affiliate, and their in-kind contributions would be nominated through par shares at $100. So that's the only distinction. And I have hesitated, being a businessman, I've hesitated both asking and or accepting, because some firms have made the offer already, all the while knowing that there is a risk component when you do that. Okay, with the state saying, we like this, we bless it, that's one level of risk. With my partner and I operating our office in Fairbanks, making our information on the website available while our arithmetic works, that's a different level of risk for a businessman to make when he's going to dedicate the internal resources of his company. He's gonna start building costs as we have in our development. Tom and I have got a year of this, and it starts adding up real quick. So to answer your question, the state's sanction, as we can call it, would invigorate participation in kind sweat equity. If we don't get that within about a month and a half, our 2014 will be delayed to 2015, I'm just being honest with you. The risk there is, for example, back to Senator French, part of the issue with the AGDC estimates as they were developed when steel prices were double in 08. If you track back the metals indices, you will see that in 08 they were double what they were in 09. Since 09, since they have corrected themselves to today, they've crept back up about 32%. Metals as a whole on a blend. So the longer we wait, since we're all about steel, pipe, our CAPEX is going to have to go up. The CAPEX you see there are with pipe quotes I secured in November.
Senator Wagner.
And the last question I've got, and this goes back to the memories I have of the TAPS line. It was going to be 900 and some million dollars, and it worked out to be, I think, close to $8 billion by the time they got through building it. Why do you feel that with currently what you and your partner put together, that you can stay at the level you're talking about here? To me, this looks like a really tight, tight budget. And what have the people, other than, you know, I know you're offering shares and everything, but you're going to have to finance part of this. And what do the people you're going to finance this thing through say about that?
Well, what we've done, and if you access our website, you will find another set of PowerPoints, and they're called sensitivity analysis.
what we've done, being businessmen. By the way, I've estimated and built four pipelines in my career. Not the greatest at it, but I'm pretty good. What you do typically on a major piece of infrastructure like this before you get the malady called blindsiding, because that's what happens to you when you work on a project, you get to love it. So what you do is you run sensitivities and you say, okay, what if we are wrong? Well, if you go on our website, what you'll see is a curve. And at the CAPEX we're at today, we're at point X. If we double that CAPEX, what would it do to the cost? It's all there for you. And I can tell you that what we're looking at in the interior, okay, at an average energy cost in the interior of about $22 per MCF on an energy equivalent basis, if I took the worst case for volumes, in other words, spread deterioration, let's say one of our nominating parties is a mine. It may not come to fruition. We think it will, but it may not. We looked at that. What if our cost, I think our top side went 64% higher. What if our cost? Well, you'll see a curve in there, and it'll tell you exactly what that cost is. And under a worst case, we're just a little more than half of what today's alternatives are. That's the magic of pipeline economies.
Thank you.
Yes, we will obtain those slides, and I will distribute them to the committee so that the committee members do have that information. It's a very interesting project. I'm sure that there will be more questions from the committee members, certainly after they review these slides. And so we thank you very much to Energy Cura for showing up today, and again, we need to now transition to Mr. Larry Persley. But again, we thank you for the interesting presentation on small diameter distribution of gas from Prudhoe to Alaskans in the interior.
Well, likewise, we'd like to thank the committee for the invitation and its attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brief at ease. Senate Resources back to order. We welcome Mr. Larry Persley, Federal Pipeline Coordinator's Office, and we welcome you.
Thank you. For the record, Larry Persley, Federal Coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, which is a long title and a long way of saying it is my job to represent the federal government to help you see if we can get a pipeline built to take gas to Alaskans in the lower 48 states. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to appear today. I'd much prefer to appear before a state Senate committee than a U.S. Senate committee. They have no sense of humor in Washington, I have found. Not about themselves, not about anything. I've got about a 10-minute presentation I'd like to run through just to give you an overview of where I see the potential for a gas line, the state's involvement, and a brief summary of the report we issued last week, which was referenced at the start of the meeting. But I'm here to tell you that a North Slope natural gas pipeline is possible, but to turn it into probable will take the right market conditions. It will take investors willing to risk tens of billions of dollars, and it will take state involvement. The right market conditions could come as the nation's electric utilities convert from coal to cleaner burning natural gas. More demand would drive the need for more supply, and that gives Alaska Gas a chance in the marketplace. If investors see demand building in the years ahead, if they see higher prices for gas in the decades ahead, Alaska has a chance to compete against shale gas. At some point, though, Alaskans will need to decide how much they want the pipeline and what is the fair share for the state, measured not just by how much wealth they expect from the state's share of the gas itself, but what the state would look like without any wealth to share. The reality is the North Slope has thrived on oil, only oil and nothing but oil for 34 years, but it's not going to continue thriving without a way to get gas to market. A gas pipeline serving the huge North American market would make Alaska a much more attractive option for the tens of billions of dollars needed to maintain the aging oil pipeline, to pump more oil from older fields, and to explore for new reserves. If you add up the investment dollars, the goods and services bought in Alaska, the jobs, tax and royalty revenues, and a gas line could help provide a strong economy for decades to come. It's not just about counting the last tax dollar. It's about a state with a future or a state running out of oil money. I know Alaskans are frustrated with the pace of a gas line development. I've only been on the job 11 months, and I'm frustrated already. But the reality is that big projects always take longer than expected. While we're waiting for the results of the two gas pipeline open seasons that closed just 6 months and 4 months ago, our office, the Federal Gas Line Coordinator's Office, decided it would be helpful for people to have some numbers to ponder, some policy issues to consider as they look at the state's fallback option of underwriting a small in-state gas line. The report we issued last week had been underway for about as long as the open seasons. Roger Marks, who was the contractor on the report, and I have been working on the report since last summer. It was not intended to pick a fight with the state in-state gas line. Our purpose was to promote discussion, maybe to stir things up a bit, so Alaskans would know their choices, the costs, and the options, so that when the time comes, they could make the best decision for the state's future. The direct and indirect benefits to the state and its residents of a large volume North Slope natural gas pipeline to serve in-state and lower 48 markets would be substantial. Tax and royalty revenues would be significantly higher than from a small in-state gas line. A large volume main line to lower 48 markets would spur increased investment in new oil and gas exploration in Alaska, and the pipeline tariff for gas deliveries within Alaska would be substantially less with the economies of scale of a large pipeline. Our report reviews the opportunity cost to the state of a potential subsidy of a small in-state line versus the option of possibly applying the same amount of state leverage to a larger mainline project. If state involvement could mean the difference as to whether the mainline is ever built, the state would be far better off committing the equivalent investment in some form or another toward the mainline project rather than as an in-state pipeline subsidy. Our report determined that even if you could sign up large-scale industrial customers to justify building an in-state pipeline carrying 500 million cubic feet a day from Prudhoe Bay to South Central, the state would have to kick in an estimated $4.2 billion toward construction costs to end up with gas at the end of the pipe equivalent to the $7-plus dollars per MCF per 1,000 cubic feet that NSTAR paid on average for Cook Inlet gas last month. That analysis makes several assumptions, including that you paid producers $2 per 1,000 cubic feet for the gas, and that the state's subsidy came as a one-time grant to help cover construction costs. If South Central utilities and customers were willing to pay 25 or 30% more than they did last month for gas, you could cut that state subsidy in half. In terms of revenue to the state, an in-state line at 500 million cubic feet a day would generate an estimated $326 million a year in royalty, production tax, property tax, and corporate income tax revenue to the state. That assumes private ownership of the line, no change in state tax rates, and gas worth $2 per MCF at the wellhead. We took those same assumptions and looked at a line carrying 4.5 billion cubic feet a day, mostly to lower 48 markets, plus whatever is needed to meet in-state demand. That project would generate $2.3 billion a year in public revenues. Though keep in mind that assumes no change in the state's tax rates, a debatable assumption, certainly, given the tight economics of the project and the likelihood that the state would need to do something with its tax structure to help the economics of the project. The North Slope gas line has a chance, but the economics are tight and they are risky. If Alaskans believe in a better future with a pipeline, bringing gas to Alaskans while creating jobs and billions of dollars in new public revenues, it's time, while we wait for the open season results, but it's time to start looking at what the state can do to help move the project's economics in favor of construction. Not a subsidy, not an open-ended financial incentive with nothing in return, rather sitting down with all of the parties to look at the problems and find answers. And the federal coordinator's office is willing to help with that. And with that, questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your analysis, it looks like you calculated the benefits of the production tax, assuming that oil and gas have been decoupled. And I'm just curious why you make that, why you've made that assumption when we passed legislation to decouple. It's been vetoed. And what would be the impact of gas remaining coupled to oil on your numbers?
Through the chair, you're right, Senator. We had to make an assumption. We debated a lot about that, couple or not decouple. We decided to decouple. It's cleaner to look at. And the truth is, depending on the price discrepancy of oil and gas, it's going to come the same. We assumed decoupling with all of the expenses assigned to oil. So if you decoupled and assigned some to gas, there'd be more write-offs on gas, less write-offs on oil. Your oil revenue would go up. I guess it really doesn't make a difference in the comparison between the two. We just have to pick one or the other. And we are assuming, and it was my decision, that if there's ever going to be a gas line, there's going to be some sort of decoupling.
Senator French.
Thank you. A slightly different tack. Your report, the report here does not address distribution costs. I know that's particularly an acute problem in Fairbanks. Are you aware of any estimates about what it would cost the consumers, really, of Fairbanks to pay to install a gas distribution center?
Through the chair, Senator, no, we haven't looked at that, though I was talking with John Davies last week of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, and they have done some preliminary numbers. And John's response to me was, is it's not as expensive as you think.
Well, that's excellent.
Right. I've asked for a copy of the report. You know, we did look at this. Federal law requires mileage-based tariffs on an Alaska gas line. So gas, as far as Fairbanks, is only going to pay the tariff for the miles from Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks. And our estimates, if you paid working off the numbers from the open seasons, if you pay $2 per MCF for the gas on the slope, you can pull the gas out in Fairbanks, another $2 and change for treatment and tariff. That's going to be pretty affordable gas, but you're right, Senator, you're still going to have to get it from that main pipe into town and distribute it.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think going back to the earlier question with Senator Wilkowski, I'd have to look at those numbers. I'm not quite that comfortable to draw the conclusion that you know, the in-state gas line, the way our system works, would not, in effect, be a negative impact. We'd have the political consequences of changing that with the tax burden falling on the Alaska consumers. And I think there'd be other complications. So I wouldn't be so quick to jump to that conclusion. I'm just trying to sort out the message that you're bringing us today, and from your earlier comments, I took it to mean that, you know, if we're going to look at a $4 billion subsidy as an example for an in-state gas line, we may be better off to own $4 billion worth of a $40 billion pipe along those lines.
Well, through the chair, Senator, I guess, you know, we were careful not to propose what you do with the $4 billion in here. That would be federal interference in state affairs. But we did. I guess I don't see necessarily as equity. It could be, as you said, the point was in the report was to say before you write a $4 billion check, if you're prepared to write a $4 billion check, why don't you see if you can get something more for it other than a small line that doesn't produce much revenue. There's things the state could look at in terms of deferring property taxes during construction. Perhaps you'd want to consider deferring production tax revenues during some early years. There's things you could do that did not involve taking an equity stake or writing a $4 billion check, but could have an effect on the economics to improve it, and you could argue would have a reduction today in state revenues to be recovered later on in the project. So I guess I would see when the time came, I'm sure you'd come up with a lot of hopefully constructive ideas, short of writing a check.
Hello.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I think some of those concepts were already in the originals negotiated draft agreement, I guess, under the Murkowski administration when he was working on that project, a lot of those type of incentives. So we'll have to wait and see what comes out of the open seasons if, in fact, we get to know what some of the concerns and requests are that are embedded in both the Denali and the AGEA process. And that won't be till summer at the earliest.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with a lot of what you say in terms of clearly the big line. Moving the gas along the big line as far as you can saves you on tariff. The problem that we have is you have people in Fairbanks who are paying $2,000 a month right now for heat and hundreds more for electricity. And oil's projected to be $100 a barrel or in that range for close to that. For the next several years, we don't have a big line in our sights for at least a decade. In Cook Inlet, we're running out of gas. Well, we're not running out of gas. We have gas. We just haven't got it to market. So, I mean, the problem that I see is the next 10, 15 years. I mean, the advantage of a small diameter pipeline is if you can get it built quickly, you have gas that you're providing some relief to people, to a significant population, for probably a 6-7 year period. I don't know that Fairbanks can go on for another decade without some sort of relief. So that's the dilemma that I face as a policymaker.
I guess through the chair, the question is if someone's saying, look, I don't think, no disrespect to the presenters who came before me, I don't think it can be built that quick. But I guess regardless whether it can or not, if a private enterprise wants to build something, I guess I don't see anyone at this table stopping them. But I think you've got to, I guess the point I'm also trying to make is long term, where do you see the state's economy? And I'm telling you, without a way to get gas off the slope, oil investment up there looks a lot less attractive, and you've had a great ride, or we've had a great ride in Alaska for 34 years off oil, without a gas line, you're not going to get that again. And the question is, or the issue, the problem, is the immediate energy needs of Fairbanks and Bush, Alaska. I think, unfortunately, with the LNG plant closing in Kenai and storage hopefully coming to the South Central, they may be okay. The immediate problem may be energy costs in Fairbanks. Long-term, it's having public revenues in the bank to pay for all the services that the state provides. A small diameter pipeline isn't going to do that.
Sure.
Yes, Mr. Senator Stedman.
Just as a brief note, you know, when I think back about some of the initial discussions we had dealing with PPT, when we were there was a proposal to move away from ELF, and they were comparing the taxes under ELF to this new regime, and they were using ELF as the base case or the benchmark. And some of us were arguing that shouldn't be the benchmark; it should be the international marketplace, and there's a benchmark error in your comparison going forward, which made the PPT discussion problematic from the get-go. And I'm not so sure here that we're not making also a benchmark error in that when we talk about the gas and the energy needs into Anchorage area and looking at, as you'd mentioned, a 20 or 30% increase. But if we look at anywhere else in Alaska, I think in Fairbanks, it's three times that. In Southeast, with our 12 cents a kilowatt, it's three times that. So I'm not sure that's even the proper amount that we should be using as a benchmark for energy to be delivered in the Fairbanks, or excuse me, in Anchorage. And if we do use that as a benchmark, then that begs the question, what about the other areas, if it's Fairbanks or Southeast or Western Alaska, and how do we treat those?
Through the chair, Senator, I guess how you treat them is the prerogative of the legislature. I'm just pointing out, to treat them, you're going to need money, and the only way you're going to get any money is to have a big pipeline moving gas off the North Slope. As far as the variables, as you discussed, Table 1 on page 8 of the report shows that if you're not targeting $7 gas delivered to NSTAR, if you want $9 gas in South Central, you can cut your subsidy in half. You're right. South Central has had it very good on energy prices compared to the rest of the state. And we just had to pick some numbers. And we said, well, $2 on the North Slope, plausible. Today's price for gas, plausible as a point to price to, but then show the variables. If you can get gas for $1, if you have to pay $3, if you're targeting 9 in Cook Inlet, deliver 10 star or 7, to give you some ideas. Through the chair, this wasn't a, I think it's a good report, but this was not a comprehensive report. I can tell you the total budget for this report was under $6,000.
Just as a kind of a heating cost comparison that's been circulating around dealing with Homer, and it's on a BTU equivalency and dealing with their energy needs. But natural gas would be, or electricity at 14 cents a kilowatt would be four times that price on natural gas. So you can pick, you know, a multiple of three or a multiple of four, but when, you know, when people look at Southeast and they say Southeast is very fortunate, we have cheap hydroelectric, again, you got to take a look at what's your starting point. If you look at it as the energy cost of in Anchorage, it's extremely expensive, three to four times, and the same with Fairbanks and other areas. So, you know, all I'm saying is, you know, as a point to, at the committee, and I've mentioned this to the AEA presenters, we need to, I think, have a discussion here on an energy equivalency basis across the state so we can see and we can adjust it for degree days, because clearly Fairbanks is colder than Ketchikan or other communities. But we need to get a feel for the energy comparisons in a BTU equivalency across the state when we start driving down the road to set state policy, so we can try to keep a balance and we're fair to all Alaskans.
For purposes of the record, we've been joined by Senator Menard, so welcome, and Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on a slightly different topic, this first time we've seen you, I know we've talked in the office about this. You're on gavel to gavel. Maybe you could take this opportunity and just give us your quick assessment of where we are in the pipeline. We've all heard that the world has changed with the shale gas finds in the lower 48 since we adopted AGEA. If you could just give us your impression of where we are in the AGEA process and if things have changed dramatically, that we need to change course.
Well, through the chair, our office has no preference between AGEA, non-AGEA, so we track it as a gas line. Look, the world has changed for natural gas in the past few years since the legislature passed AGEA. There's no question about it. The shale gas boom, the glut of LNG in overseas markets. But we have a problem in Alaska where we look at the day's price. We've done it on oil for three decades because that determines the capital budget for the year or the politics for the year. We're doing it on gas. It really doesn't matter what today's price is. It matters what the companies think it's going to be 10 years from now. And I'm laying out here, if the nation pushes more toward gas instead of coal-fired, and that depends on federal legislation, depends on EPA, it depends on court challenges after people sue over the EPA, there will be a demand build. You see it already with Denver is going coal-free. There are a lot of utilities converting. If the demand builds enough, then it's a question, can you get Alaska gas to market in 2020, 2022, whenever the first gas is, at the same price of the next shale play? I think that's possible. The state's going to have to restructure its finances to allow it to get in there at a competitive price. And that's what the companies are looking at now, I believe. And I have no personal knowledge of the open season bids, but I can tell you they're not sitting there between TransCanada, Exxon, Denali, Alaska Pipeline Project, and the bidders. They're not talking about the state fiscal system. It's not within their purview. They're talking about other conditions, project delays, cost overruns, when's the date if it looks like it's going to go, if there's permit problems, who pays for those kind of delays. I think it is possible. It depends on national policy. Again, clean energy, coal versus gas. And it depends on the economics, and that's about the only thing the state can affect is the economics. I still think it is possible. You talk to a lot of analysts, and they say it's possible in the 2020s that Alaska gas could get into market, depending on the economics. Another thing is depending how much states, counties, communities around the country, what kind of limitations they impose on shale. Shale gas is plentiful. There's hundreds and hundreds of trillions of cubic feet of shale gas that is technically recoverable. Whether it is economically recoverable under new water quality restrictions and other limitations put on it by states, that will be the question. We just don't know that yet.
You put together a report which, for good or for bad, is arguably to say, hey, don't invest in a small-scale line. If you want, stick your money in the large-scale line. I know maybe that wasn't the direct intention, but that's the impact I take. And what I want to know is how do the economics of shale gas how are they compared to the economics of a gas pipeline at this point in time, an Alaska gas pipeline?
The chair, Senator, depends on which shale play. You need a lot of water to produce shale gas for the hydraulic fracturing, anywhere from 2 to 5 million gallons per fracking operation on well. So it depends if you're in an area of the country where there's a lot of water and it's available cheap and you can dispose of the water cheaply, that has lower costs than other places where disposal costs are going up, where communities want you to truck it out one load at a time to a treatment plant. So there's no set price for shale. But looking ahead, it's like logging, it's like anything else. The early stuff is the cheap stuff. 10 years from now, it's not going to be as cheap to produce shale. There will be further advances in fracking, in horizontal drilling, but water disposal and land costs will go up. Just to get back real quickly to the report, I guess to me the takeaway on the report was before you write a check for $4 billion, why don't you just see if somehow you could use that to make a difference and get something more for it. If you can't, hey, you need gas, go for it.
further questions? Thank you, Mr. Persily.
Thank you.
You're always welcome, and the policy issues are significant when one talks about gas pipelines and the tens of billions of dollars and potentially subsidies of, as you are indicating here, $4.2 billion all the way down to small diameter pipelines with significantly lower construction costs. And the question is benefits to the citizens of Alaska and when, and all of those policy issues are in play right at the moment. And I think that these are interesting times for all Alaskans. So thank you for...
Thank you.
With that, Senate Resources is adjourned for Monday, Valentine's Day.